Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. Welcome to the Vietnamese podcast. I have Dr. Andrew Wells Dang with me today. He's a senior expert on Vietnam at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And we will be talking about the USIP and the funding in just a bit. Dr. Andrew Wells Dang leads the Vietnam War Legacies and Reconciliation Initiative. This program focuses on addressing the enduring impacts of the Vietnam War, including issues that are related to Agent Orange, unexploded ordnance, and the search for missing persons.
Hi, Kenneth. Great to be here.
We met a few years ago at the United States Institute of Peace. I was on a panel that Aaron Steinhauer invited me to be on out there. And, you know, there's a few things that we are going to talk about today. The funding for the USIP was taken away a few months ago. And I hear that it's just been reinstated. Can you walk me through the kind of the logic of the administration of taking away the funding for the USIP?
Well, I don't think there's any logic to it. Maybe just in terms of background on the U.S. Institute of Peace, it was founded over 40 years ago by Congress as a place for education and exchange and research about peace building, which is a broad term that includes like preventing conflict, trying to deal with currently ongoing conflicts, and recovering from past conflicts. And so what we do is, you know, not diplomacy like the State Department does, but rather research and like people-to-people exchange and dialogue. So in my case, between Americans and Vietnamese, including Vietnamese in the country and outside the country. And then we also then talk with governments and private sector and, you know, others to link people together and hope to make progress on some of these post-conflict issues, which, as we can see, it's 50 years since the end of the Vietnam War, but there are still effects in Vietnam and effects on people that lived through the war and since.
You know, the idea of having a United States Institute of Peace is to, I guess, mitigate future wars and help out with things that are lingering, sort of like the POW MIA or Agent Orange issues. When you take away the money for the funding for something like this, it makes me think, are things like that related to partisan issues? Or is it just truly that they're just trying to cut the budget and make the United States government expenditure lean?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just cutting the budget. They really tried to put us out of business by firing or claiming to fire our leadership and staff, taking our building, taking our assets. If it's a question about what budget Congress appropriates for us every year, that can sometimes go up or down. But this is really about the existence of the Institute because it's a nonpartisan, independent institution that was founded by Congress. Therefore, it's not controlled by the president. It's not part of the executive branch. And this was done very intentionally by the members of Congress that founded USIP in the 80s, who were both Republicans and Democrats. Many of them were veterans. One, for instance, was Senator Spark Matsunaga from Hawaii, who's a Japanese-American veteran of World War II, wanted a place that promoted peace to prevent conflicts like the one he was in happening again. Others were veterans from Vietnam had similar motivations, and they wanted to make sure that this institute was outside of partisan politics and wasn't subject to whatever the preferences of a particular president happened to be. So we work with U.S. administrations, both Republicans and Democrats, and we also work with universities and nonprofits and people around the world who are supporting peace and conflict resolution. So this was really threatened by this administration. With the ruling of the judge a few days ago, we're now in a position to continue our work, and we have to find out what the future will look like.
I'm still perplexed on why the funding was pulled. I still don't get it. I still don't understand the logic to go after this particular institution.
Well, it's not just us, right? And it definitely has nothing to do with our work on Vietnam or Southeast Asia. It's much broader than that. And, it's look at it together with the shutdown of USAID, cuts in foreign assistance, cuts to Voice of America and Radio Free Asia, even taking over cultural institutions like the Kennedy Center, which you wouldn't think are political. All of what the U.S. does in terms of communications and the arts is also part of our reputation in the world. Soft power is a word some people use for it, right? People around the world look to the U.S. for information, creativity, leadership in these areas. And that's what USIP aims to do in the area of peace building and research and education about peace. I think it's the nonpartisan and independent nature of us, and we're not something that fits in the executive branch. And that's the reason why the court ruled that the institute, is not subject to leaders being fired by the president. So it's really about that kind of constitutional issue. I'm sure the legal cases will go on, right? It's not done. But we won a really important victory earlier this week.
You know, when I think about the United States as a whole, and I think about the wars that we go through, and I think about the cycle of war, like Afghanistan, the Gulf Wars, Vietnam, Korea, I don't think that we are ever going to not go to war. But then again, there's this Institute of Peace that exists for the explicit reason of mitigating us going to war or trying to figure out if there are peaceful solutions. But being at the USIP for you all these years, do you think that there is ever a chance that the United States will really think about going to war in the future or co-create future wars?
I think we can learn from past wars, including the Vietnam War, as well as Iraq and Afghanistan. We have learned some lessons from these wars in terms of military strategy, how the public knows about it. We ended the draft after the Vietnam War would be an example of a lesson. But there are other lessons that we haven't learned, and perhaps we repeated in Afghanistan and Iraq that we didn't need to if we had really looked at the lessons of Vietnam more carefully, for instance. There's also an American tradition of peace, though, that exists alongside this. And, you know, it's, again, led by people, religious groups, veterans themselves have been an important force for peace. And we can see that in the establishment of relations with Vietnam after the war, which really didn't get started until the 1990s with normal relations and starting of trade and Vietnam's own opening up to some extent to the world. And that's a positive story of how some Americans and some Vietnamese have worked together to learn lessons and overcome the past. It doesn't mean all of those problems have been dealt with, right? We're still dealing with many of them now, both the physical legacies like Agent Orange and missing people, but also the long-lasting personal effects of displacement, you know, survivors and how they experience that trauma. And that healing is also still going on in communities in Vietnam and the U.S.
So before we get into more conversation about peace in Vietnam, I am curious about how you have a last name, a Vietnamese last name.
Well, I mean, maybe I can tell the story of how I got involved with Vietnam in the first place. Initially, after I graduated from college, I worked as a volunteer helping with refugee resettlements. And this was the early 1990s with Amerasian families who were coming to Georgia at that time. And a few years after that, I was teaching in China and had the opportunity to visit Vietnam. And I was really curious. It was just at the time that the U.S. embargo was being lifted. In early 1994, and independent travel to Vietnam by Americans, I guess it had been possible for a couple years at that time, but it was still not very common. So I arrived in Saigon on the first day of Tet, because that was also the Chinese winter holiday, and then went up to Hanoi and other places. In the south and the north at that time.
What was that?
1994.
Yeah. Right there.
And you know, I was interested. I thought this was a fascinating country. Especially Hanoi didn't conform to what I expected it to look like.
What did you expect it to look like?
Oh, I don't know. Something more like Eastern Europe, which I had been to before. So you know, Soviet style. And there's not much of that in Hanoi, right? It's especially at that time, it was mostly older buildings,
right,
still with a lot of French influence and traditional charm. And it was very quiet. It compared nicely with Chinese cities at the same period as well, which were actually more sort of, crowded, but Soviet in look. Anyway, I had a positive impression and thought, oh, it'd be interesting to come back here sometime. 3 years after that, I was applying to work with Catholic Relief Services. And they asked on the application, where would you like to go? And I put Vietnam because I knew they had recently opened a Vietnam office or reopened. I didn't think I would get it. I thought they would probably send me somewhere else. But indeed, I got the position in Vietnam. And so I moved to Hanoi in summer of 1997. The world of international nonprofits in Vietnam at that time was just starting to expand. And, you know, it was mostly Vietnamese staff who were starting to do community development projects. There was a feeling of great hope and optimism about the future of Vietnam and an incredible sense of teamwork among I think there were 12 of us with CRS at that time. One other American who was the country director, and 10 Vietnamese staff. A few months after I started, a new education program officer started. So we worked together for that year. 3 years after that, we were married, and that's where the Dong in my name comes from. We decided to put our last names together. We have two children who are 20 and 16 now, and we all have the same combined last name. We lived in Vietnam, both in the north and the central region, until 2019. And we've been now in Virginia near Washington, D.C. for the last 6 years. So we've all seen both countries, and we're a bicultural, bilingual family.
You speak fluent Vietnamese, right?
Yeah, I mean, I lived there for 20 years, for, I guess, more than half of my adult life. Right, so that, enables me in my work at USIP to work with Vietnamese counterparts and Americans, and be a translator when needed.
I want to ask about this decision to, it fascinates me, because I think we're looking at cultural dynamics, we're looking at gender dynamics, both in East and West. And it is a cool conversation starter, especially in Vietnam, because most of us have the same last name. So there's that.
It's a win-win situation, right?
There's all kinds of funny business going on. But when you show up with a last name, a Vietnamese last name attached to an American last name, you must get a lot of questions. And here we are. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but we're here. How did that decision come about?
I mean, I guess I always thought that the idea that women had to take a man's name in traditionally in the U.S. was not equal. And I had friends who had hyphenated their names or combined them somehow. And of course, it's more common for just like Vietnamese to keep your last name and not change it after marriage, right? Which we also could have done. But I think, we saw our family as a statement, a combination of cultures. And I think cultures and identities are additive. You can have more than one. So, my kids are both American and Vietnamese. They're not half anything. And they can choose perhaps which parts of that identity or culture to emphasize as they get older. But they have both of them, and they're both in our names.
I love it. It's such a brilliant move. And I think that when you are so ingrained into the work that you do in Vietnam, and you become part of the people, and your children carry both identities, I think it's a really beautiful thing.
It does take some explanation, though. And advice to listeners, a lot of websites don't accept a hyphen as a character in your name. And that's kind of a pain. If I had known that, I might have considered something else.
Just make it one word, Wells
did. Yeah. I don't know.
It threw me off in the beginning, too. When I met up with you, or when you were, on the panel, I was just I was curious to figure out, but I never, we didn't have time. I figured that out.
And sure.
And I met your wife, Yang, and we figured,
Right. I mean, I have a Vietnamese identity too. And my wife has an American identity too, right? I'm not a Vietnamese citizen because it doesn't work that way.
As somebody who I would consider you on the inside today, but at one point you're on the outside looking into the Vietnamese cultural space. And seeing, there's probably three or four moving parts, which is the American identity that you have, the Vietnamese identity from people in Vietnam, the Vietnamese American. And then I would think for you, there's like a fourth culture, which is where I think you exist. I exist in a third culture, but I would even surmise that you exist in a fourth culture. Was it ever confusing? What were you going to say, Andrew?
I think we exist in all of them. And, you know, you can, maybe you're more familiar or more adept in one than the others. And so it takes some practice and time to learn that. But no, I don't think it's confusing. I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, my kids when they were little, somehow they knew instinctively who to speak Vietnamese to and who to speak English to.
Right.
Yeah, it's usually pretty clear to me which culture or identity I'm in at a particular time. Are you talking about being inside and outside? I think I'm some of both. You know, when I'm with my in-laws or close friends in Vietnam, then I'm definitely on the inside. But if I'm meeting Vietnamese people that I don't know, then they would see me still as, oh, you know, the foreigner who happens to speak Vietnamese. It takes some time to, you know, to get to know each other and to be able to show up that way. As far as Vietnamese Americans, it's the same way, I think, right? I mean, we were together at one point where I was singing some Vietnamese song on karaoke. I think that did more to convince people that I was actually part of the group than anything I might have said.
I'm like, convince or confuse? Oh, that was fun. But I wanted to go back to actually a little bit more political, which is you going back in 97 and the climate for Vietnamese American has never really changed, especially as the older generation, you know, anti-communist. And, you know, being somebody who presents as a white person, but living inside of the community of Vietnamese in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and understanding that there's a Vietnamese American perspective that is really hurting from the loss of the country. And you're getting to see and experience all of it because, you know, you have now family in Vietnam and in Hanoi and spending time with Hanoi. I'm sure close friends with people in the government in Hanoi, but also being in DC, seeing many friends that are, you know, part of the Vietnamese families that are part of the people who left after the end of the war.
Yep.
And that must put you in a very flexible sort of position to kind of think and process how people feel about the movement five decades after the war. Yeah. I'm curious to hear from a professional standpoint of being somebody from the Institute of Peace from the United States and somebody who is actually, you know, I would probably consider you somebody who understands Vietnamese culture so well in Hanoi. Can you tell me a little bit about how does it feel to witness the transition through all these years?
Yeah, there's a lot to say about all of that for sure. And I would just add one thing to it, which is we also spent 8 years living in Central Vietnam, Hoi An specifically, and, you know, had neighbors who were both ARVN veterans and Viet Cong, and, you know, like many places in Vietnam and during the war, the city itself was controlled by the Republic of Vietnam government, and the rural areas outside the city were in revolutionary hands most of the time. So depending where you were, even in the city, it varied. And, you know, that was a different culture and experience from living in Hanoi as well. And I've also spent time in Saigon and other parts of Vietnam. So there's that kind of variation too. But as far as me politically, I mean, I try as best as I can to be neutral, right? I work for a peace institute. We want to understand and work with people of all kinds of different perspectives.
I understand where people in Vietnam who have lived through the war, what they call the subsidized period, right, the sort of hardcore socialism and the poverty that came with that, and then the Doi Mui period of opening and economic growth and everything that's happened since then, including people in Vietnam who are critical of, to some extent or to a great extent, of what the party has done and is doing. So there's that kind of internal view and different views. And I also, you know, want to understand and respect what Vietnamese in the U.S. have experienced and been through. The end of the war, fleeing the country in various different ways, right? And the trauma that went with that. Those who stayed and were imprisoned and then got out later, right? Had a different set of experiences. And the different generations of people than those born in the U.S. versus people who came to the U.S., you know, already as teenagers or adults. All of those are valid experiences of history and conflict, trauma, right? I think, you know, talking about the physical legacies, part of the power of talking about Agent Orange or MIAs is that they affect everyone. That there are American veterans as well as Vietnamese from all sides who suffered those kinds of losses and health effects. So that in some way, those experiences can be the basis for a conversation that brings people together. And yeah, I mean, back to what I was saying about USIP being nonpartisan and independent, right? Try to play that mediating role when it comes to Vietnam and U.S.-Vietnam relations. You know, as a U.S. government-funded institute, and you know, myself as an American, I can't speak for any group of Vietnamese, or I don't think I can solve, you know, issues that are still dividing Vietnamese in different places. But I hope that the Institute and our programs can be a way for people to come together and start have more of those conversations.
Yeah, it definitely is a good breeding ground for these kinds of conversations. I want to know if you have any stories or moments that you can share about reflective moments of the human impact of the work that you do and the U.S. Institute of Peace as it relates and pertains to Vietnam.
Sure. I'll tell a couple from last year. And the first one is about our work with searching for missing Vietnamese. So what's called the Vietnam Wartime Accounting Initiative, started by the U.S. Department of Defense and Vietnamese partners in 2021. As part of that, last June, USIP brought a group of U.S. MIA family members and U.S. veterans over to Vietnam. And we started in Hanoi, and some people then went down to the south, and other people to the central region to search for mass graves that the U.S. veterans remembered from their time in Vietnam. So after a kind of wave attack by Viet Cong guerrillas, for instance, they would bury all the bodies, and they still knew where some of those bodies were.
The American troops are burying
the American troops buried the dead after the battle. Yeah. So we went to more than 20 such sites, in the center and south. And then the U.S. Families who are children of missing Americans also went back to the sites where their fathers had been shot down or were missing.
And this isn't the first time. There have been similar groups that have done this in the past, right? But I think this was the first time that we brought such a group together with a group of Vietnamese families of the missing in the North. And they could share their stories with each other. And really identify with each other's stories and suffering and many years searching. And in some cases, they had found some answers and others haven't. One of the USIP staff in Vietnam went along with them. And, you know, she also has relatives who were missing and shared those stories with the Americans. So those kinds of relationships develop. It's partly about finding remains and getting answers for families, no matter what side they were on. But it's also about the relationships that develop from that and the shared human experience that, you know, everyone has to an extent after the war. The second story I'll tell happened in the U.S., and this was at our annual U.S., Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia War Legacies and Peace Dialogue. So we've had now four of these conferences over several days. And so a lot of different people come to them. We put together different roundtables and panels. Last year we had one on Vietnamese Americans and War Legacies that discussed missing from the Republic of Vietnam, the Bien Hoa or Binh An Cemetery, where many Arvin war dead are buried. And we had a conversation that included people from Vietnam who had come over for the dialogue. So a retired general, the Vietnamese Army, who's now the president of the Vietnam Martyr Families Support Association, was part of this dialogue with Vietnamese American speakers. After that, a group of them went to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. You know, they agreed that we need to look for missing and resolve injustice on all sides. So we've started an initiative together with Texas Tech University and the Vietnamese American Foundation, which is also in Texas, to support maintaining and preserving Bien Hoa Cemetery and looking for information about RVN missing. And this is something that hasn't happened enough and needs to be seen alongside with the longstanding U.S. MIA program and the work that we're involved in with the Vietnamese government to look for missing from their side. Because this is it's a humanitarian question. It's more than 50 years since the end of the war. And not everyone is ready to do this in either country. But there are people, including leaders from both the community here and in Vietnam, who are willing to take some steps on it. So this is something I have hope that we can make progress on in coming years.
When I think about this sort of like this relationship that we have with Vietnam, both in the Vietnamese American communities and U.S. government reaching out to the government of Vietnam and working sort of hand in hand, I'm not sure if other countries partake in that sort of thing, but are you aware if sort of the governments of Iraq or Afghanistan also do this, you know, with a prior enemy or somebody that we were at war with at one point? The U.S. government and government of Vietnam are sort of working now in tandem economically, politically. Do we do that in America with other countries that we go to war with?
Well, I mean, one example certainly would be with Japan and Germany after World War II. I think what's different in this case is that the efforts to reconnect were led by veterans themselves with Vietnam. And, you know, the governments in many cases started to join that later. The importance of the MIA issue is certainly unique to the U.S.-Vietnam experience too.
Right? That's still very...
It's still going on. So the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, which is the part of the U.S. Department of Defense that runs the MIA program, works all around the world. And they're, you know, still finding missing from World War II and Korea. And they also would work in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, although it's hard to get access, I think, to some of those places still. So, I mean, I hope that in the future it's possible to have people-to-people as well as government-to-government relations with other countries where we fought wars. It's not easy. It takes a lot of time. Even if you look at Vietnam, it was 20 years from the end of the war to normalization and really the start of a lot of the cooperation in the 1990s. Ideally, it wouldn't take that long. And those are some of the lessons and processes that, you know, we want to learn from at USIP too.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall Credit Card Bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
You have a PhD from the University of Birmingham in the UK, and it's about civil society networks in China and Vietnam, which reflects your expertise in this governance and civil society dynamics. And I often wonder, with the rising rising power in China, is a war, and it's a very simplistic answer, I know there's probably a lot of nuance behind the answering of this, but is there a chance that we will one day go to actual war with China? Could it be a possibility?
It's possible. I think it can be prevented. And I don't think anyone in China or the U.S. really wants it. So I'm not worried about, say, one country deliberately starting a war very much. I do worry about missing signals from the other country because we don't understand, or something inadvertent getting escalated sort of by accident, which is actually the way that World War I started, for instance.
Right. That's what I was going to say. I mean, all fights and battles and wars between people, between countries and nations are like these little accidental skirmishes that
right.
lead into these full-blown, you know, death and destruction of millions of people.
Yeah, so, I mean, could some incident around Taiwan or in the South China Sea / East Sea, whatever we want to call it, lead to a bigger conflict? Yes, it could. And, you know, you can be sure that the U.S. military and the Chinese military have like contingency plans for this because that's their job. But it's really important that diplomats and other people who are involved in this find ways of de-escalating these crises. And so USAP can't do that by itself, for sure. We're not a large institute with the ability to, you know, tell others what to do. But we can, for instance, bring together people from different countries around China in Asia and our allies and talk with the Chinese and look for ways to understand better, reduce the risk of these accidents happening.
I was watching a documentary, a short documentary on the sinking of the Titanic. And it was like halfway through, there's a little factoid about a set of binoculars that were kept in a locked cupboard inside the this glass, whatever, or this section of the boat, you know, of the captain's office.
So they couldn't see the iceberg coming. And then,
yeah, the architect or whatever got fired, or he left a job for another job, and the key was with the key was they didn't know where to find the key to the binoculars, and that's how the Titanic basically, whoever that front forward observer was supposed to look for whatever, couldn't get the binoculars out, and then this whole catastrophe happens, and you hear about these things like in World War I, World War II, where one little thing leads to a chain reaction of other things.
Right.
And you would hope that guys at the United States Institute of Peace are around to find the keys to this, to the binoculars. Like, where is it? So we.
I hope we have more than one set of binoculars, right? That it doesn't depend on just one guy with a key. I mean, that is a concern if we're cutting foreign assistance and communications and some other functions that the U.S. government has been doing for decades. Maybe that's fine in the short run, but in a case where there's a crisis, do we have the resilience and like backup systems that are helpful to prevent that? I mean, another historical example is that after World War II, in the McCarthy period, the State Department let go of most of its Asia specialists because they were seen as sympathetic to communist China, in some cases simply for having correctly predicted that the communists would win the Civil War. And that was one factor that made it difficult for the U.S. to understand what was happening in Vietnam 10 or 15 years later.
You let all the binoculars go.
Right. And if, I'm not a historian. Others understand this more than I. But, you know, if I look at the U.S. during the Vietnam War, it's clear that the U.S. didn't understand what North Vietnam was doing or thinking. Didn't even know that Vo Nguyen Giap wasn't in charge, it was actually Lê Duẩn, and so on. But at the same time, the U.S. didn't understand what the South Vietnamese were thinking and doing either. And they, you know, continually irritated Ngo Dinh Diem and his successors by not really listening and understanding what their vision was.
Right.
So I guess it's understandable not to understand your enemies, but we didn't really understand our friends or supposed friends at the time either.
But how much of the U.S. government is checking in with the United States Institute of Peace? You know, I mean, there exists an organization in D.C. that really focuses on how to achieve peace. But how much of the government is actually checking in with you guys and saying, hey, we got these like strategic things that we need to analyze. Like, what's the best way here? Is that happening, or is it something totally different than what we're imagining?
No, it, it It has been happening and does happen. And I mean, I can tell stories even in the last few months when we were shut down. Some of my colleagues were asked by U.S. government counterparts to brief them on things. And so, I mean, we play that role with Congress, but also parts of the national security structure, right, will come to us because we have experts in specific countries and conflict areas and technical areas like mediation. Doesn't mean we know everything, right? We can't cover all parts of the world equally. But yeah, I mean, that's I think one of our functions is to be that kind of resource for the U.S. government and for others who want to understand better what's going on. And the work I do on Vietnam is actually different from some other colleagues who are working more on the prevention or dealing with active conflict situations, depending on what the needs and that context are.
When I am talking about Vietnam, the modern Vietnam, and I'm talking to friends and we are talking about the goodness, the kindness of the government of Vietnam to its people and what they're trying and what they're really trying to kind of achieve in Vietnam by building a better society, I am pushed back with this idea of human rights in Vietnam. And how do we come to terms with this lack of human rights awareness that's happening from inside the government? How do we as Americans, Vietnamese Americans, sit idly by and just go and vacation once a year in the resort areas of Vietnam and turn our heads in another? I get asked that quite a bit. That how could you say that the Vietnamese government is doing good when clearly they have locked up people for speaking out?
Yeah, I mean, the Vietnamese constitution has all sorts of human rights protections in it. And Vietnam has signed United Nations human rights conventions, pledge to abide by them. So yeah, they should be following what they've committed to. It's easy to see many ways that it doesn't measure up. Human rights is a big concept, though. It also includes social and economic rights. It includes things like gender equality and children's rights and things like that. Which sometimes the Vietnamese government will emphasize some area like that where they're doing relatively better as a way of not addressing areas where they need to improve. Probably all countries do that to some extent. It's also tricky given history and the U.S.'s role to be, sort of taking a we know better approach to these things, especially now. But there are for sure many brave people in Vietnam and in the U.S. and elsewhere that are working to improve human rights. And that, you know, that's part of the, it's related to peace building, right?
That's why I bring it up.
Creating the future world that we all want to see requires understanding where we come from, right? Acknowledging the past, both positive and negative. Having relationships and discussions with people and having then some vision of the future that we're working towards. There definitely are people in Vietnam with that vision that want to achieve it.
You know, I don't want to simplify this question, but it's going to come off as very simplistic as a lot of these questions do sometimes. But I am expecting a much more complicated answer, but
okay, I'll try.
When you look at war in the last 100 years, what are we fighting for? You know, is it really because I want to take your gold and land from you? Or what, in your mind,
is the kind of the common denominator of war in all of the world? Again, it's a very simple question, but I was wondering if it's like an 80-20 rule, you know, 80% is like, we want to dominate because we want to capture their gold and their people, you know, but I don't think it's that simple when I think about like Palestine and Israel. What do you think is the main driver that we are always going to war?
And I mean, not all wars are the same for sure. But a lot of the wars that are going on now, and I think this is also true of Vietnam, is that it's a war about independence and people being able to control their lives. And in the case of Vietnam, you had two opposing views of the best way to do that, two different states.
Ideology, right?
That's ideology. But both sides in the Vietnam War had a vision of independence that they wanted to achieve.
Right.
One of them won and the other didn't. And, you know, the U.S. came into that with a different set of ideological viewpoints that didn't completely align with what was going on in Vietnam, and that was part of the problem. But yeah, I mean, people want to be in control of their lives, to live with dignity, and they're willing to fight for it if that's being violated. You know, lots of effort after World War II was put into an international structure, the UN, human rights conventions, judicial and economic institutions that would preserve peace. And part of that was giving colonized people independence. There was the whole movement of that. But there was a lot of conflict around it, even with those institutions in place, because they tend to be dominated by a few people or a few countries. And in the world we're in now, all of that seems to be called into question or breaking down, that post-World War II system. And we need to find out what can replace it that will work better. And that's pretty urgent. I don't think it's about going back to what was the situation before, because that wasn't always good for people or working either, right? But what comes next? And if it's something that most of the time does protect people's rights and aspirations, then we can have a world with less war. And if that doesn't happen, for sure, we'll continue to see the kinds of conflicts like we see now around the world.
Your work and your organization is sort of like a thankless job. It's sort of like insurance. You know, when you know, it's like, okay, well, if there's no wars, then nobody talks about, you know, you.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to give ourselves credit for a war that didn't happen.
Look at me. There's no war. Look at what we've done.
Right.
So the world doesn't work that way, especially as it relates to war and peace. But when there are wars, or when there are wars that are boiling up, what can the USIP actively do? Or does it actively engage with politicians to say, hey, like, that's dangerous. You've got to really be aware of what's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, in the case of some of the active wars in the world, my colleagues have been looking for ways to mediate, get other countries involved, look at what are the conditions for peace talks, right? There's the idea of shuttle diplomacy, where you're going back and forth from one side to the other to try to understand their points of view and find a way to bring them together. It's really hard to do. And the challenge, take the
Russian invasion of Ukraine, neither side, even now, is ready to end the war. Or the terms by which they would end the war aren't acceptable to the other side, which ends up to be the same thing. So that's extremely challenging work.
But prevention isn't easy either, right? But yeah.
There's somebody at USIP working on this?
There have been, yeah. We have teams working on each of the main regions of the world. Yeah, trying to find ways to keep conflicts from spreading. What are the chances for bringing warring parties together? How much we're able to do that in this current situation, I think, you know, will remain to be seen. But that's our mission and intention, and we do this, you know, alongside of the efforts of the U.S. and other governments too. So, you know, in some respects, it's finding ways that we can contribute to work that others are doing too.
My last question, and it's a touchy question for people on both sides, but I like to hear your thoughts on what you think of the 50th anniversary of the end of the war.
Well, I was planning to be in Vietnam, actually, at the time, and there were several delegations of U.S. veterans and U.S. peace activists that were there, and that you know, attended some of the official events, but also had meetings with different Vietnamese counterparts and media and so on. So that would have been interesting to witness. But in the end, because of the takeover of USIP, I wasn't able to go. I did attend a vigil at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial that a small group of Vietnamese Americans put together, which I thought was a very conceived and thoughtful thing. Of course, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial has the names of Americans, not of Vietnamese, but it's a place of memory. It's a place that's important for all Americans, where we can also remember people from, you know, from different sides, and imagine that they're also represented there. I mean, the 50th anniversary is a marker in the sense that we've come this long since the end of the war. Of course, we can look back at what happened then in April 1975, but also look at what's happened since then. You know, some of it's progress, some of it still remains to be done. But I hope that at this distance, we can see in a somewhat broader way what that situation is and be able to work together on things that are of common interest, just as the U.S. and Vietnamese governments are doing. You know, Americans and Vietnamese, including Vietnamese Americans, can lead on what happens in the next 50 years. So I think in that way, it's an important marker as a reflect on where we've come and where we're all going together.
Andrew, thank you so much for today. I am breathing a sigh of relief that the USIP is now funded again and that you can carry out your mission.
We'll see how it goes. I think there are a lot of things to be worked out, but yes, we are back in existence and we will continue our mission as best we can. So thanks a lot, Kenneth, for inviting me. Great to talk with you.
Great talking to you too. And if anything changes, let's get back on and talk about it.
All right.
Thanks, Andrew. Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.